This is Food for Thought. Call Carol at 866-823-1077. And now, it's Food for Thought.
Welcome back to the second hour of Food for Thought with Carol and Mike. We are at the Beacon Building at 814 Elm Street, and we are live on 107.7 WTPL. And I just want to take a couple moments to thank some of our sponsors. Express Jewelry Center, right on South Main Street in Concord. You can check them out at expressjewelrynh.com. Integrity Health Coaching Solutions, where I was this morning, by the way. You can check them out on the web, integrityfit.com, your coaching solutions company. As well as Belmont Hall and Restaurant, belmonthall.net, top quality foods made fresh for over 50 years. And we are back. And I believe that we have our next guest is all ready, as she always is. And let's welcome on Linda Ditch of What's Cooking in Kansas. And you can check out her blog there and back again at lindaathompson.blogspot.com. Welcome, Linda, to Food for Thought again.
Hi, Carol. Hey, Mike. It's good to talk to you again.
Linda, very nice to talk with you. You are in a part of the country that gets some really wicked weather. How has it been the last few days?
You know, so far, we're in Topeka, we haven't had any rock and roll kind of weather yet. You know, just some rain and a little thunder off in the distance. But, you know, we're still waiting for the big guns to come out, and they will. They always do.
Do you like stormy weather? Because I know people either love it or hate it. I love thunderstorms.
I do, too.
Oh, I love them. It's really amazing to be here, and, you know, the land is flat enough that you can see them coming from miles and miles away and just kind of watch as the clouds start keep moving closer and the lightning's in the distance, and it's amazing. It's a fun thing to watch. I remember when I lived back in New Hampshire, I could hear the thunder. I'm like, where is it? Where is
the
storm? Because you couldn't see anything. There's so many trees.
So, Linda, your kitchen is always in working order, of course. But you're always cooking something. So, what's been on the stove this week?
Well, I actually just posted about an hour ago a blog post with a vintage chocolate cake recipe, which is so funny. You were talking about chocolate in the first hour. Well, here you go, a vintage chocolate cake recipe.
Chocolate cake. Now, what makes it vintage? Like what?
It came out of an old cookbook.
Oh, okay.
I love it.
Duh.
Very good. Good branding there.
Well, what happens, the friends and family that live nearby, it's a little harder for the ones that live far away, but the ones that live nearby, when their birthdays come around, I offer to make them whatever they want. You know, birthday cake, cookies. One of my brother-in-laws is wanting me to make my baked beans recipe that my late husband loves. You know, I'll make them whatever. I've made whoopie pies. I've made chocolate chip muffins, which that's cake to me. But, you know, and it was a muffin. And I've made all different kinds of things for people's birthdays. And most often, people ask for chocolate cake and chocolate frosting. And I've made many, many chocolate cakes, but the recipes I've been using were they're dense cakes, almost like a brownie more than a cake. And I wanted something that was a little fluffier, a little more, okay, I hate to say this, cake box mix kind of cake. fluffier and softer, but without using a box mix. So I went looking in some old cookbooks, and in a 1963 Pillsbury Family cookbook, I found a recipe that it was what I started off with. But of course, anybody that knows me knows I can't leave a recipe alone. I tinkered and changed everything, and I came up with this one. And I've made it twice now to rave reviews, and so I think it's my chocolate cake mix, my chocolate cake recipe that I'm going to go for from now on.
So it's Linda's vintage chocolate cake.
Yes, that's basically what it's going to be. If people ask for chocolate cake, this is what they're getting.
Very nice. So you live in Kansas. You've lived in New Hampshire. How different is dining? I mean, this is two different worlds, really, Midwest and New England. So have you had to kind of change things up and kind of alter your cooking style for your family or friends?
Yes. Back when I lived in New Hampshire, people on the East Coast, I don't know if it's just exposure to lots of different, there's different kinds of cuisines here, but people in Kansas tend to go, want to keep very, very basic, very simple, you know, pot roast, roasted chickens, chicken fried steak, fried chicken, you know, some of those country dishes that you think of that you grew up with. And, of course, seafood is, you know, getting fresh seafood is impossible. It always has to be frozen. But, and not a lot of people, I mean, they eat lake catfish that they caught out of a lake or bass or crappie and those kind of fish, though, and not the ocean fish that I was used to dealing with in New England. And I can get some of those, but, you know, it's previously frozen and shipped in, and I can't, it's not like I can just go get it from a fish shop that got it from the Boston Fish Market earlier that morning, you know, anymore. So, but yeah, around here, there are things like people tend to lean towards Miracle Whip instead of mayo. They you know, and not to mention the terminology of, you know, they talk, if anybody says, you know, it's all pop here and not soda or tonic. If you ask for tonic here, they're going to think you're talking about hair tonic or something.
Oh, my God.
True. That's true. Really? You know, a basement is a cellar here. There's so many.
Right. Yeah, couch versus sofa, you know, sneakers versus tennis shoes.
Right. But I grew up in Michigan, so it's almost the same as Kansas. So I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
You get it, yeah. But I know it was funny because when I moved here, and especially when I started cooking for my late husband, we I had to tone down the seasonings that I was used to. You know, I'd make my Italian dishes that I had been making and everybody loved, and it was too Italian. There was too much Italian seasoning in it. I had to kind of tone it back and tone back on the garlic and, you know, mild it up a little bit. So it wasn't quite as, to me, as flavors packed as I was used to cooking. So, but I've adjusted to it. I know, and it also depends on who I'm cooking for. You know, my late husband's family, they're all like, it's the pot roast, the chicken, fried chicken, you know, basic cooking that way.
Comfort
and,
food.
Yeah, exactly. Where, you know, there are, I do have some friends I have over for dinner that I can get a little more creative with. I fed them pasticcio, you know, from a recipe I got there in New Hampshire, and I can do a little more fun things that way. And I know the people I can ask to go to Indian food. Don't eat Indian food with me, but so yeah, you know, you can mix it up a little bit, but yeah, it's a little toned down here compared to out there.
All right, talk to me about you. I'm looking at your website, your blog page, and you made a penne and penne a la vodka dish that looks really, really almost looks like a bolognese dish. Is there some, you know, comparison there, or what? Tell us about that.
Well, there's no meat in it.
Oh,
I take that back. There's bacon in it, but that's the only thing that's in it. But it's got onion, bacon, and tomato. And then what makes it tasty is you add a little vodka and cook it off so that the alcohol cooks out and it smooths out the flavor. And then towards the end, you add cream and lots and lots and lots of good Parmesan cheese. So, and it makes it this. It's a tomato sauce, but there's a creaminess to it. So what makes it.
So, Linda, you're this blogger, which gives you a platform for people anywhere in the world. Who's reading you? Who's connecting with you? Is it worth your while to be doing this?
Oh, good heavens! I have, I get close to 20,000 views a month on my blog from everywhere.
Linda. Good for you.
Yeah, from everywhere. I mean, most of it's from the United States. All over the United States. But then my next, and then Canada comes next. Great Britain, people from the Ukraine, China, Romania. And it's funny because different things spike at different times. For when my sister-in-law and her husband adopted 4 children from the Ukraine. And I don't know if it's because they adopted the Ukrainian children or what, but all of a sudden my readership from the Ukraine went up for a while.
Oh, my. That's funny.
And so, you know, it varies. And a lot of times it depends on what I post. I posted a recipe a few weeks ago for New Orleans-style barbecue shrimp. And next thing I know, people from Louisiana and all over that are big fans of New Orleans-style food come into the blog to look at it. So, yeah, I get views from all over. And it's funny because I started this blog. I mean, I had been a food writer in New Hampshire for quite a few years, and when I was moving back this way to the Midwest, they were like, but how can we read your stuff? And can't we follow you? And then somebody said, you should start a blog so we can follow you back there. And I'm like, okay. So I did. And it's been going ever since.
And, you know, and then you went on your cruise and, you know, and you reported all about the cruise cooking and going into the back kitchens and, you know, and all that. So you've kind of, you've made a name for yourself on your blog. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm very lucky to have it. And then now with the writing that I do here, I write for newspapers and magazines here, but then I can take some of those recipes and share them with a much wider audience than I would get with the newspaper here, and vice versa. Some of the things that I've written about back there, I can turn around and then share it with, you know, put it on the blog, and people here get to read it too. So, yeah, having a blog, it's a lot of fun. It's a great vehicle to be able to put out whatever, you know. And if there's a recipe I want to do that doesn't seem to fit any place I'm writing for, well, I can just put it on the blog. And let it and put it there, so and people can read it there. So it's nice, you know. I teach writing workshops, and I'm getting ready to have some start up here. And you know, back when I started, if you wanted to write something, you had to find somebody to publish it, or you just kept it for yourself. Where now, you know, anybody can write because you've got the blog format. You can just put it up there and see what happens. So. And it's been nice to be able to do that.
Were you a member of the New Hampshire Writers Project when you were in New Hampshire?
Yes, I was.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that organization. They do a lot of great work in promoting writers and helping them find their way and get started in what they're doing. I like that. It's a great organization. And if you're a writer in New Hampshire, you need to join them because they're great. It's a great resource and a great networking and way to be around other writers.
Final question for me. You mentioned barbecue a moment ago. Doesn't Kansas typically get the like Kansas City get the big props for the best barbecue, other than maybe Memphis?
Oh well, no, Kansas City is the best. The barbecue in Kansas City is absolutely the best. I'm less than an hour away from Kansas City, so I may be a little prejudiced, but there's all kinds of. You know, Kansas City Joe's to Gates to Arthur Bryan's. I mean, the classic barbecue names that have been around for decades. And the fun thing about Kansas City barbecue, it got started because after the Civil War and people were and slaves were former slaves were leaving the South and trying to come, you know, to different places and starting their businesses. Well, you know, they brought their barbecue with them. And so they would set up these stands outside of the sports stadiums and sell barbecue. Well, the announcers on the radio up in the stadiums would talk about this incredible smell that was coming from all these barbecue stands. And the next thing you know, Kansas City Barbecue became famous. People, you know, they'd go down and get boxes to take with them when they hit the road to go other places. So, you know, that's how it became famous, was all through sports broadcasters, baseball, football, sports broadcasters talking about the wonderful smells outside the stadium. So,
wow, that is cool. That is cool. Well, Linda, thank you for calling in. And maybe next week we can kind of start focusing on some grilling. So maybe you can go into your archives and look for some grilling recipes and maybe some barbecue recipes and stuff like that. How does that sound?
That sounds good. And just remember, it's very different. Grilling and barbecue are two different things.
That's right. Well, I'm a smoker myself, so I'll be able to jump in on that conversation.
Yeah, I heard about your big green egg that you got.
Those things
are great.
That's my boy toy, or my you know, my big boy toy.
That's his big boy toy.
Yeah.
He doesn't buy cars
those
and stuff
are great.
Like that.
All right. Yeah, good to meet you, Linda, and we look forward to seeing you next Thursday. Thanks.
Okay, we'll talk to you then. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. That was Linda Ditch of What's Cooking in Kansas. You can check out her blog there and back again at lindaathompson.blogspot.com. And you're listening to Food for Thought, and Carol and Mike will be right back.
Food for Thought returns after these messages on 107.7 The Pulse.
And we are brought to you this afternoon by Red Arrow Diner, Manchester, Milford, and now open with the drive-thru in Londonderry, and Belmont Hall and Restaurant, Belmont Hall at 718 Grove Street in Manchester. Top quality food made fresh for over 50 years. As we say good afternoon to a gentleman I actually had the pleasure of speaking with a couple of years ago. His name is J.M. Hirsch, author of a really, really useful and creative book called Beating the Lunchbox Blues, Fresh Ideas for Lunches on the Go. Now, this guy's got serious chops in the food world. He is, I believe, still the national food editor for Associated Press, and he's got a really helpful food blog, which is lunchboxblues.com. It's good to talk to J.M. Hirsch once again.
Thank you so much.
Yes, are you still the Associated Press food editor?
I am. I love my job. It gives me the opportunity to eat and see everything that's going on in the food world around the world. And I love my gig. It's just a wonderful opportunity. I work for New York, but I get to live here in New Hampshire, which I feel is the best of all work.
I would agree with you on that. So the foreword in the book, the introduction, is by Rachel Ray, who took a liking to you, and you can tell us about that in a minute, but did you know how Rachel Ray got her start?
I do, actually. You know, she really did not plan on going into food, and she grew up in her mom's restaurant, and then she later worked in some food venues, but never really planned to make a TV career out of it. And she went back home after kind of bottoming out in New York, as I think, you know, half of the people who moved to New York end up going through. And she went home back to upstate New York, and she was doing food demos for a local purveyor. And she started doing them on, you know, like little snippets on the local news channel. And somebody discovered her, and pretty soon she was doing her 30-minute meals, which, you know, then snowballed into the amazing, you know, career that she's had since
that,
then.
Yeah, that is incredible. And what about your connection with Rachel Ray? Why did she take a liking to you?
Well, I've known Rachel for years because of my day job as AP food editor. And when she recently, a couple of years ago, she switched publishers to Simon & Schuster. And as part of that deal, she got her own imprint, which means she gets to pick authors that she would like to publish under her brand, so to speak, with Simon & Schuster. I had been doing my lunch blog for a number of years at that point. And she obviously cares very much about how kids eat. She's very active in kind of promoting healthy eating for kids and reform of the school lunch program. And so she and I have, like I say, had known each other for a long time. She knew what I was doing on the blog, and it was just kind of a very natural and happy connection that worked out for everyone. I was thrilled.
And you've been on her show a number of times, so that's great exposure as well.
Well, it is. You know, I've for part of my job, as well as for books that I write, I do a fair amount of television these days, and I'm an introvert at heart, so learning how to do television has been a crazy but wonderful and scary but thrilling opportunity because, again, it's really, I'm clearly not natural, which anybody who sees me on TV can tell, but it is a great skill to learn. You know, I mean, as we get to a certain age in life, we stop learning new skills, and it was one of those things. You know, I've been a journalist for 20 years, so there wasn't a whole lot more growth opportunity there in terms of skills, but it was this awesome opportunity to learn how to do something that made me utterly and completely uncomfortable. And it was a lot of fun. It's hard to cook on television. It really is.
Because it's so quick, and you got to look at the camera, you got to think about what you're saying. Beating
exactly.
The Lunchbox Blues, J.M. Hirsch, our guest, introduction by Rachel Ray. All right, so I talked to you 2 years ago when the book came out. Your son, Parker, I think was 9 at the time, and he is about whom much of this actually rotates around in the examples and in your blog discusses his reaction to your lunches. Is he 11 now, and is he still as finicky as he was a couple years ago?
He goes through phases, you know, like most kids his age. And, you know, at the moment we're back into a bacon phase, we're back into a chili phase, and I've discovered that, although he doesn't know this yet, luckily he doesn't tend to listen to the radio, so I think I'm safe in saying this, I can put anything into a chili, and it really doesn't matter what it is, as long as I put it in a chili, he'll eat it. But if I just present those like vegetables or whatever on the side, he wouldn't touch them. But if I bury it in a chili, it doesn't matter. And so he is as picky as any other kid his age. But he's also a great eater. You know, this is a kid who loves sushi. He loves Ethiopian food. You know, he's an adventurous eater, but he's also, you know, a picky, you know, 10-year-old boy. So, you know, kind of cuts both ways on that one.
Well, you know, being the food editor for Associated Press, what do you see as the new food trends? Do you see any food trends right now?
Oh, absolutely. You know, vegetables are where it's at, which much to my son's annoyance. you know, that it truly is where it's at. You know, the kind of conventional thinking at the moment is that anybody can take a great piece of meat and make it delicious, because meat is delicious. But it takes some special skill to take what many people would consider a plain old vegetable and transform it into something just mouthwatering. And you're seeing this more and more with kind of these higher end chefs, you know, in New York, in LA, in Chicago, where they are just specializing in sometimes very common vegetables, but also, you know, more obscure ones. But you know, my favorite is the cauliflower. Cauliflower is like the darling vegetable of the moment, where people are turning it into steaks. And I don't mean like trying to turn it into a veggie burger or anything like that. This isn't faux meat. This is taking a head of cauliflower and slicing it into a slab down the center, and then grilling or slow roasting that slab of cauliflower until it's tender and savory and just unbelievable. We recently tested a recipe actually of turning cauliflower into the kind of the ricey filling that you would normally use in dolmadas or stuffed grape leaves. And that was phenomenal as well. And you're seeing it just pop up over and over again. And of course, Brussels sprouts were the big vegetable a couple of years ago. And before that, there was broccoli. And, you know, these common vegetables are becoming very hip because these very talented chefs are realizing that they can take these very simple and, let's face it, inexpensive ingredients and work magic with them. So, you know, a lot of people are really celebrating this, not just because it's something that you can more easily replicate at home than a lot of these kind of fancier preparations that are served in restaurants, but it's also healthier. You know, people are paying a lot more attention to what they're eating. There is a lot more focus on produce-based diets. And, you know, we're not talking going vegetarian. We're talking that more people are trying to eat more produce and whole grains. And so you're seeing a lot more of that, and people are kind of responding to that. So that's kind of a very cool trend that we're seeing right now.
Back to your lunch book here for just a moment. I'm reading part of the introduction here, just to show what a wry sense of humor you are and the tongue-in-cheek. Now, if you're, I'm quoting now from Beating the Lunchbox Blues, J.M. Hirsch, our guest. Now, if you're one of those people who somehow finds the time to craft sandwiches into cutesy animals or carve cheese into flowers and hearts, congratulations. And good luck with your therapy. Now go away.
It's true. You know, when I started this blog, oh God, like six or some odd years ago now. And I didn't plan to do it. I didn't want to do it. It wasn't my idea. I was having lunch with the editor of a women's magazine, and we were comparing war stories about the lunches that we pack for our kids. And when I was saying some of the things I make for Parker, she was just like, "You have got to start a blog about this. People would love this." And I looked at her and I said, "Are you kidding me? Like, I'm not even that interested in what my kid is eating, never mind other people reading about it." And so, you know, I kind of ignored her, and a few months went by and she kept pestering me and saying, no, seriously, you've got to start this. So I became this petulant child, and I said, "Fine, I'll do it. But you'll see, nobody's going to read it, and I'm going to put no effort into it." And so I just got a free blog template that was like minimalist. It was just white with just black print and nothing else. And all I did every day was post a picture of my kid's lunch, followed by a couple paragraph description of what was in the picture. And that was it. And that's all I did. I didn't try to spread the word. I didn't do anything. Well, it caught on, obviously. And within about 6 months, I was on Martha Stewart's show. You know, NPR had done something on it. I mean, it had snowballed again, and it was just kind of crazy, and so it just kind of took on this life of its own. But always I said I have to keep it real. You know, there are a lot of blogs out there about, you know, parents who craft these intricate, gorgeously ornate insane, frankly, lunches where clearly they spent hours crafting the cheese to look like a mouse, or you know, doing the flower-shaped carrot cuts. And I mean, just, I don't know who these people are or what sort of time they have on their hands, but I work for a living, and my kid's not going to sit there patiently while I'm carving carrots into a rose for his lunch. And so I always said, you know, I've got to keep this real, because the people who are reading it, they just want real ideas, because they don't have any more time than I do. So I did take some heat for that comment in the book over the years. I certainly had people comment to me about how offensive they thought it was, because they're really into their bento box style lunches. And I'm like, again, if you've got the time to do that, hey, more power to you. And you know, good luck with the therapy. You're going to need it.
Well, I'm sorry that I kind of reignited that little what storm we're talking about here. That's funny. Did you have good lunches growing up? Did your mom or dad or whoever packed your lunches? It was the same thing. I had the same three things every week, basically.
You know, I had the same exact lunch every single day, but it was by my choice. It was a whole wheat bread with the crust cut off. With American cheese and mustard, and just yellow mustard. And I ate that every single day with an apple for years. And then there was one day that my mother forgot to cut the crust off. And for whatever reason, that just tipped me over the edge. And I didn't eat the crust that day. I just had eaten up to and around them. And I went to a Catholic school where the nuns would, you know, beat you if you didn't do what they said. And so you had to open your lunchbox for inspection at the end of lunch. And when I presented my lunchbox to the nun, you know, she started screaming at me and telling me I had eaten it. I burst into tears. And I threw my mother under the bus. I said, I promise that my mother will eat them when I get home, so that we won't throw them away.
That's cool.
I don't know if my mother did in fact eat them, but it got me out of having to eat them.
Oh my gosh.
I'm still recovering from the scars.
I've noticed that, yes.
Now, JM, you live in Concord, and do you go out to eat at all? And what types of places do you like to eat at?
You know, here's the part where I get in trouble. I get asked this question a lot. And when I'm asked where I go out to eat in New Hampshire, I usually answer New York. I love living in New Hampshire. I truly love living in New Hampshire. My job is in New York. And I choose to work from home here in New Hampshire so I can raise my family here in New Hampshire. I love our way of life here. We don't have a very great food scene, though, unfortunately. Vermont, oh my God, they have an amazing food scene. Maine, killer food scene. New Hampshire,
Manchester has come a long way.
Manchester has come a long way. And there are actually a couple of great restaurants down there that I do like, and a few that I've been needing to check out. But to be honest, with a kid in tow, I don't get out as much as I would like when I'm here. So I tend to eat out mostly when I'm on the road. And so, in fact, I have a killer road trip planned up for May, when I'm going to literally eat my way around the globe. Ooh. So that's where I go out to eat.
Wow. So we need to connect with you at least once on this trip when you're at some far off exotic place and eating scorpions on a skewer or something.
Absolutely. Well, you're welcome to follow along on Instagram. It's, you know, JM_Hirsch. I'm going to be I'm going from Manchester, of course, the beginning of all great trips, to Chicago, to San Francisco, to Seoul, South Korea, to Tokyo, to Dubai, to Copenhagen, to Reykjavik, back to Boston.
And over a period of what, about a month or so?
About 3 weeks.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
And he gets paid for this, Carol.
No kidding.
I'm going to eat an awful lot while I'm on that trip.
Don't you need an assistant?
Somebody to make sure the food is good, right?
There you go. Make sure it's safe for you to eat.
Exactly.
Now, when you're going to start like one of these trips, like just give me like what is the day in the life of JM when you're on, you know, on these kinds of trips?
When I'm on a trip, well, you know, most of my trips, to be honest, are not nearly this sexy. Most of my trips, I'm going, you know, I just got back from D.C. the other day, and I was speaking at a conference. But I make sure I pack in as many meals as I can. When I'm in New York, which I go to about once a month, I tend to pack in as many meetings as I can over the course of the day. But I will do sometimes like 5 or 6 meals over the course of the day because it's an opportunity for me to get out and explore and eat at places and talk to chefs that I don't get to see, you know, in person on a day-to-day basis. So I schedule my meetings at, you know, different restaurants that I want to try and or different cafes. And so I just kind of, oftentimes I'll start first thing in the morning and I end up going from one restaurant to the next, and finishing the evening at some bar at, or, you know, some speakeasy or something, and getting back to my hotel at around 2 a.m. I know it sounds wonderful that you're just, wow, eating at some of the best restaurants in New York all day, but actually it's exhausting, and by the time I get back to my hotel, I am wiped.
I bet you are.
I know you have a lot of sympathy.
Yeah. Can you hear the small violins? All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to find out if you indeed survived the killer kitty incident here in just a couple of moments from his blog, which is lunchboxblues.com. J.M. Hirsch, author of Beating the Lunchbox Blues and Fresh Ideas for Lunches on the Go. It's Carol and Mike on the Pulse, WTPL 107.7, and we'll be right back.
Food for Thought returns after these messages on 107.7 The Pulse.
J.M. Hirsch, author. He's also the national food editor for Associated Press, world traveler, and we are going to hopefully connect with him one time during May while he circles the globe eating his way from hemisphere to hemisphere, and that sounds like a lot of fun. But what you need to do, J.M., is you need to make sure that you don't get any more infections from your killer kitty. What happened there?
Oh, gosh. Well, we're a sucker for a sad cat, and we tend to collect cats with issues. I don't know how this happened, but we just did. We have a blind cat. We have a cat with no teeth. Ash. We have a total of 4. And right before Christmas, there was this cat with these weird ears that we found online, because, of course, you can find anything online these days, and we find weird cats. And she has these kind of, she's part Scottish Fold, and so her ears are kind of folded down, but they're also kind of turned up, and they point in different directions. She gives her a very quizzical look. And she had a bit of an adjustment period when she moved here, and she bit me one day. She's actually much calmer now. She bit me one day, and sure enough, it got infected, and it was, you know, the good old trick of the year. We have a soft spot for weird cats. I don't know.
Did you say you had one with no teeth?
Yes.
I can't even picture that.
he gets on fine. He eats plenty. He used to live on a bus, and we rescued him. He's a happy cat now. They're all very happy now, but they all have strange backstories. One has no eyes. My favorite is when people ask me, well, how do you know she's blind? It's like, well, she has no eyes. I'll go out on a limb on that one.
Yeah, exactly. So do you prepare the food for your cats? Because I'm going to guess they all have varying diets. Some people do their own dog food, baby food. How about cat food?
You know, I think that's like one more step of crazy that I'm not willing to do. Yeah. I mean, we're crazy cat people. I mean, but let's just accept that. But I'm not willing to prepare cat food. They get bowls of dry food from which they can forage at will, and my son's responsible for filling those bowls, and that's all I'm willing to do.
Does Parker have any interest in cooking? Does he seem to take the interest from you?
He is certainly an interested eater, and he is willing to try new things. And, you know, I can generally take him to any restaurant and have him try stuff. He doesn't always like it, but he's willing to try it. He used to cook with me a lot more when he was younger, but now that we're getting into those tween years, that's not so cool anymore. In fact, I was told how uncool I was the other day when I tried to drop him off at school, and it was, you know, 8:30 in the morning, and I was dressed in shorts and stuff, so I was going to work out afterward. No, I'm not allowed to walk him in because I didn't look appropriate, apparently. So, I don't think I look that bad. But anyway, so we're entering that phase.
Well, that kind of breaks your heart, doesn't it? But you know what? That'll change before too long, because his girlfriends will discover there's always really good food at the Hirsch household, and they'll be over.
Exactly. It'll come back around.
Yeah, so tell me about this bacon binge I've been reading on your blog here at lunchboxblues.com. You went and got like 5 pounds of bacon?
Yeah, you know, we go through a lot of bacon in this house. And now here's the thing, you know, a lot of people, you know, assume that, oh, gosh, this bacon's very fatty and all that. You know, I am a big believer that if you eat real food, and meaning food that is minimally processed, food that is local, organic if possible, and food that isn't pumped full of chemicals and crap, I think you can eat pretty much whatever you want and have a healthy diet. And people long before us did. I truly believe that processed foods are really what's changing the American diet for the worse. And so my son loves bacon, and he is a skinny little thing, and we're always trying to put a little bit of weight on it. So we go through an awful lot of bacon in this house. And while New Hampshire may not have a great food, we do have some great bacon. And so I try to get local bacon, and we cook that. My favorite way to cook it, I'll tell you, you take the slices of bacon, and you throw them in a bowl or a bag in which you've put a ton of brown sugar and as much ground black pepper as you can handle. And you toss the bacon around in that until it's coated on both sides. And then you put it on a baking sheet and you bake it at about 400 degrees for maybe 10, 12 minutes. All right. And, oh, candy bacon. It is so delicious.
Yeah, I actually tried that a couple months ago. I didn't do it in the bag, though, which sounds like a more efficient way to get the ingredients on the bacon instead of laying it out on the cookie sheet. And then, of course, you got all the caramelized sugar that's going to burn the heck out of your oven. So,
absolutely.
Thank you for that tip. And speaking of tips, before we go here in a couple minutes, what can moms and dads that make lunches for their kids, give them a few starter points so they can make their kids look forward to the food they take to school?
Well, the first thing I always do is I start with whatever I had for dinner last night. And I am not a believer in getting up in the morning. And in addition to just trying to get my kid out the door, sitting down and cooking a meal or something, you know, that's just crazy. But at the same time, I don't want to just give him a peanut butter and jelly sandwich every day. I'd like to keep it interesting. So I always start with leftovers, some sort of leftover from the night before. So if I roast the chicken, use the leftover chicken to make either a chicken salad or throw with some cheese and some barbecue sauce. And, you know, suddenly you have a quick barbecue pulled chicken. You could serve that cold on a bun, or you could warm it up and put it in a thermos. You know, if you have leftover veggies, you can turn, you know, maybe you roasted veggies as a side dish last night. So today you put them in a whole wheat wrap with some cheese or some cream cheese or whatever your kid likes, and wrap that up into a sandwich. I mean, to me, you're already making dinner. So I'm not thinking you make anything special for dinner, but whatever you're making, you make a little bit of extra, and then you repurpose it the next day into something fresh, something that your kid will like. I mean, pasta obviously is an easy one to do that with. If you're boiling pasta, boil up a little bit of extra. The next morning, reheat the plain pasta, toss some cheese on it, put it in a thermos, and they've got mac and cheese for lunch.
Nice.
And that way they're not just eating leftovers, it's something new, but it really doesn't require any effort or time from you either. And, you know, then another thing, obviously, you know, is to involve the kid in the lunch planning. But that only goes so far. I mean, obviously, I try to take my son's preferences into account. Like, he despises broccoli and all that it represents. So, I take that into account, and I don't pack broccoli to his lunch. However, I often say lunch is not a democracy. And I'm not willing to give him veto power in the morning. I got enough going on in the morning.
That's right.
And because if I let him, he would sit there at the counter while I was packing his lunch, and he'd constantly say to me, no, not that. No, not that. I want more of that. Not that. No, shut up. No. I'm in charge. I'm packing the lunch. I will take your preferences into account, but this is not a dictatorship.
Well, I mean, things like rotisserie chicken are my best friend to use during the week for any number of different things, including leftovers and lunches.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of times I think what's a really smart thing to do is, if nothing else, when you're grocery shopping on the weekend, buy a rotisserie chicken, bring it home, and just leave it in the fridge for the sole purpose of having meat for lunch. And then you can pull it apart, as you need it. You can turn it into, you know, chicken salad. You can turn it into wraps. You can toss it with leftover pasta. You can, you know, add it to broth and pasta with to make a soup. I mean, and all of these preparations take under 5 minutes because, again, I don't spend more than 5 minutes on his lunch. Whatever the pictures may look like on my website, I never spend more than about 5 minutes making. So.
Well, they look pretty good, and I bet you Parker's probably the envy of the cafeteria.
I do hear a lot of comments from different people, especially on spare rib day. He loves baby back ribs, barbecue baby back ribs. And so I make them fairly frequently, and he loves to bring those to school. And he'll eat them cold. He doesn't care. But I have to pack lots of wet napkins when I do that. But those are a popular one among his friends.
When's he going to figure out he can be making some money with some of this food? Or does he? Have you ever heard of people trading with him?
I used to trade all the time.
You know, I know. The saddest moment of my life, when I was about, I don't know, second or third grade, this boy, I think his name was Danny, used to sit next to me in lunch, and his mom gave him all sorts of junk food, and he never ate it all, and he would always give it to me, which is perhaps why I'll blame him for as a child having weight problems, and I always ate his junk food that my mother would never give me, because back then you could trade food. I think these days the kids aren't allowed to because of the peanut allergies and all that, those sorts of concerns. I don't think they can do that anymore, but I loved that, and that was sad when one day all of a sudden he stopped. I don't know what I did to him,
well,
but I love his story.
We have come to the end of the hour and your segment, which was so much fun. And now that I reconnected with you, I'm going to find you when you are traveling the world. We'll try to set up a date where the time zones coincide with our show. And maybe have
great.
You check in from, you know, Tanzania or Lithuania, wherever you happen to be, so we can get the latest on food.
Fun, yes.
He's the food editor for the Associated Press, also a blogger. It's a very fun blog, lunchboxblues.com. J.M. Hirsch, Beating the Lunchbox Blues. J.M., we'll talk again soon. Thank you so much. Big fun as always.
Sounds great. Thank you, guys.
Thank
you. Buddy. Take care.
All right. You were listening to Food for Thought. And up next is Kale and Company. And what do we have tomorrow? Well, Comedy Cold Cuts tomorrow.
Comedy Cold Cuts,
as
Martha
well as
May
Martha
Fink.
May Fink.
And Bodie Peters.
There we go. All right. Bye, everybody.